Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
So Sugi, we've done several episodes addressing horror, but isn't it true that you're actually kind of basically unable to watch or read horror?
So the word in the script is chicken shit.
Well, I was trying to give you a break.
I appreciate that, but I will not give myself that break. I am actually kind of chicken shit about horror, and the only horror movies I watch are Jordan Peele's, and basically if it's anything else, I kind of won't do it. And I knew that when Get Out's trailer came out, I was like, oh my God, there's no way I'm not going to see this. So I tried to prepare myself by reading the whole Wikipedia entry, just spoiling the shit out of the plot before going to try to stave off the fear. But that didn't help, which I should have known, because I'm always telling my students, it's like, oh, if, like, the more the character knows, the scarier it is. Or like the more the reader knows, the scarier it is. So I just screamed ahead of everyone else. Like, I was like, I don't know, the train going around the bend or whatever. Like, I was out in the burbs in a theater full of older white people. And I was always like screaming like 2 to 3 minutes before everyone else, and people would just turn around and stare at me. It was awesome. You can't imagine a more awkward viewing experience. Did you see Get Out?
Yeah, I did. Although I avoided it for a long time because I have allergic reactions to horror films myself. But then when I saw it, it was scary, but it's not scary in a way that made me, it was scary in a smart way. And so I didn't actually find it, like, it wasn't as bad as other things that I try not to see. And it was a great movie. But movies like Get Out and Us, also directed by Peele, as well as recent films like Candyman and Them and Lovecraft Country, and Victor Laval, who's been on this show before, has his book The Changeling is out on Apple TV right now. These horror films and TV shows made by directors of color and from books written by writers of color, using horror to comment on issues of class and race, are a dominant genre in American culture right now. As the LA Times put it in a recent article about the writer, Tananarive Due, black horror is, quote, unquote, having a big moment.
That's totally true. I think, you know, not only that, but in October, which just ended, that was actually Black Horror Month. So we figured it would be a good time to talk about this genre and why exactly it is so important in American culture right now. And to do that, we're going to talk to my friend, the writer Leslie Arima, who actually went to see Us with me and was equally scared.
So was Leslie scared to see the movie? I mean, did you guys help each other out at all?
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the idea, was like we were at the same level of fearfulness, or we sort of spoke the same language of fear. And so we were okay in each other's company. And, you know, she was apprehensive, too. And now she actually writes horror. Her story, Invasion of the Baby Snatchers, was just published in this great new anthology of black horror writing, which is called Out Here Screaming.
Wait a second. Who's the editor?
It is edited by Jordan Peele. And it also has a story by Tananarive Due.
Which seems perfect for what we're doing today. I think we can officially call this a zeitgeist moment.
That's right. Watching and discussing Us with Leslie made my whole experience of horror so much better, by which I mean like tolerable, because I was basically terrified. But I feel like I have a much better understanding of why black horror has been so effective in speaking to our particular cultural movement. So today, Leslie's joining us to discuss the anthology, her contribution to it, and the role of black horror writing today. Leslie Nika Arima was born in the UK and grew up in Nigeria and wherever else her father was stationed for work. Her stories have been honored with a National Magazine Award, a Commonwealth Short Story Prize, and an O. Henry Award. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, McSweeney's, Granta, and has received support from the Elizabeth George Foundation, United States Artists, and McDowell. She was chosen for the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35, and her debut collection, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky, won the 2017 Kirkus Prize and the 2017 New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award, and was selected for the New York Times PBS Book Club, among other honors. She lives in Minneapolis and is working on a novel about you. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're in this new Jordan Peele anthology, which is so amazing. And I was scared shitless several times reading it. And we know him best as a writer and director now, but it's fascinating to think about him also as an editor and curator of others' works. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up involved in this project and what that process was like?
Yes. So I got a mysterious email. I say mysterious. So an email from John Joseph Adams. And honestly, if anyone but him had sent this email, I'd have thought it was a scam. What he said was, I want to tell you about a project, but you have to sign this NDA first before I can even tell you what it is. And I'd worked with John before, and and so I knew, I was familiar with him. And so anyone else, like, someone who I hadn't known sending that to me, like, what is this? Move to spam. And so once I signed the NDA, he'll let me know that, this anthology of Black horror being put together by Jordan Peele, and would I like to contribute to it? And my answer was an immediate yes, of course. And so I did. The process of writing the story and having the story edited, John is a fantastic editor, and so that was never a problem. But I, for me, writing the piece of horror was quite a bit of a challenge because I don't actually read horror. I scare very easily. And so I don't read or watch horror just like for my own self-preservation. And so, but I thought if I'm going to write horror, then I want to familiarize myself with this genre. And so I just sort of went on a horror reading binge. And, I read, 5 to 7 books a week. And so I just dedicated essentially 3 months just to reading horror. And so I read so much horror so quickly, lost sleep, but also really, really enjoyed myself and realized that, oh, I am missing out on quite a bit of just this fantastic genre by not and so engaging with it. And now it is one of my favorite genres.
Well, that may answer my next question, actually, because we referenced an earlier LA Times article on Black horror by Tananarive Due, and she said that during her undergraduate days at Northwestern, like, here's her quote, "Admiring Toni Morrison's Beloved got me praise in my writing classes," but then she goes on to add, "Liking Stephen King got me raised eyebrows." I wondered if you're in your early reading or study of literature, like, you noticed that duality, like, it wasn't cool or maybe thought of as artistic to like horror as much as Toni Morrison.
Right. I have never been a respecter of genres. I read everything, science fiction, fantasy, romance, even, which, gets a very bad rap. Of course, capital L literature. I had a very unfortunate ways. Yeah, like I just read everything, except for horror, which just really terrified me. And so I'm finally happy to have sort of breached first barrier. And then over the pandemic, I also started reading mystery and suspense, which I also avoided from the same reason that I avoid horror, which is that I just my tender heart.
We were talking a little bit earlier about, I had this experience of watching Get Out, and like I was just kind of not with the crowd that I was not with the right company. I needed someone who was like-minded, and so that, you and I like basically ran away from AWP Portland to watch Us. And we were both kind of like sitting there like, oh my God. So in practical terms, how do you go from being like, where do you go from being fearful to writing it yourself? And as you are writing it yourself, what is your relationship with the fear in your own story?
I actually found the experience of writing a story of horror to be very painful at first and then very delightful. And it was very painful when I had a sort of a ghost story in my folder. And I thought, oh, ghosts, horror, this is totally, I can just totally make this a scary story. And so I tried to write this ghost story that I had sort of in my folder as a piece of horror, but it resisted it at every turn. It was more of a tender ghost story than a horror ghost story. And so I kept trying to make horror happen with the story, and it refused. And then I read two books, one, The Nesting by CJ Cook, and Leech by Hyrynn Ennis. And both of those books, so they were both very voice driven, and Leech in particular was very funny. And so I was like, oh, I can do funny, right? And Leach was also body horror. It's like, oh, I can do body horror. Once I sort of arrived at that, okay, again, let's do body horror and let's try and do something that's a little bit more voicey, then it became a much easier process. But with that story, I also went back into my folder and I had sort of a sketch of a beginning of a story that started off with a woman giving birth and a bunch of soldiers with rifles sort of trained at her to figure out whether the entity she just gave birth to was a human baby or not a human baby. So I sort of reimagined that world, that's this sort of voicey body horror piece. And that's what ended up being Invasion of the Baby Snatchers, which is a story about aliens invading us through pregnancies.
And which is also viscerally terrifying.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
I wonder if you would read a bit of that story for us.
Yes, I will. And I will set this up. So this is, I'm going to read just two very brief sections, one from the beginning and one from shortly after the beginning, and I'll provide context for the piece. All right. Invasion of the Baby Snatchers. Used to be, you could tell an alien pregnancy from a human one with your naked eye, back before they figured people out. Back when post-hysterectomy rooms ballooned overnight, or an entire nursing home of geriatrics would be expecting, and everyone's like, expecting what? And sending the troops. Your baby was born with a literal cow head, 14 stomachs. That doesn't seem right. Stop counting its hoofs, heaves, hoofuses, and call in the damn troops. They had no idea how our bodies worked. It was almost funny. But of course, they learned. The woman looks so much like her file photo, it surprises me. No tired creases in her mouth, no eyes shadowed by exhaustion, none of the tells of a lived life that cameras glued to hide. She is as lovely as her home. Aside from her very pregnant belly, she could have stepped out of the photo and settled into the wingback chair she now occupies. There's nothing of the last 4 years on her, even her hands are soft and neat. Unlikely, then, that Olivia Schultz has been roughing it off-grid. Are you sure I can't get you anything? She's all smiling solicitude. The arched doorway behind her makes for a charming frame. A few years ago, I might have bought it, but that bloom has withered. I've been punched, kicked, bitten. I have punched, bitten, kicked. Two agents armed to the molars now accompany me on every intake. More if I ask. The optics of armed security dragging expectant mothers into agency fans isn't great, but after Miami, no one's complaining. And I will skip forward to Miami. They got better at making us. For one, they now stick to women of childbearing age. The days of culling a herd of dudes who found themselves 7 months along after a guy's night out are gone. Even then, the incubated specimens were always a little off. Not cow's head off, but shit like not having any joints, we called those starfishes, or having way too many, we called those what the fucks. Lots of stillborns with molars in their knees and toenails where their eyes should be. Then 2 years ago, at a Florida hospital, a newborn unfolds his jaw and eats half a nurse's face. And you think, it's Miami, it happens, until the video comes in. There's a still from that first clip that ends up as the unofficial agency screensaver. Just after the camera woman tells her exhausted wife to smile, just after she directs the nurse to hold the baby up so relatives scattered across the country can see what Tallahassee girls could do, just when things turn. The cherub gremlin dichotomy of a new child's face interrupted by a peculiar assembly of too many teeth. Mouth open so wide that chin obscures belly button. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Sugi has gone to do shots of bourbon in her closet, so I'm going to ask the next question. How did you arrive at this, twist on the classic trope of body snatchers? The story plays with our ideas and fears about genetic engineering in futuristic ways. which call back to histories of states and other abusing bodies, particularly those belonging to marginalized people, the state abusing bodies, particularly those belonging to marginalized people, for their own ends. In the foreword of the book, Peel writes about oubliettes, prisons that cause you to become invisible and forgotten, a la The Sunken Place and Get Out. In your story, the oubliette seems like the narrator's body, or this mother's body. Is that the source of the horror in your story, the idea that your own body can become a prison in which you become irrelevant?
Yes, because my personal oubliette is pregnancy and the idea of motherhood. And so...
I was going to say, when you said like aliens were being born, I'm like, isn't that happening normally? That's how a lot of people feel about being pregnant.
Right. You know, and I'm at the age where a lot of my friends are having kids or have had kids recently. And so, I think about pregnancy a lot, and it is one of those things that, that sort of terrifies me a bit, both in the physical aspect of it. You know, one of my friends developed an autoimmune disorder, you know, based on after her pregnancy, that just like never went away. She just has this now. Another friend, you know, her feet grew two sizes and never went down, so she couldn't. I was like, oh, all my shoes? Are you kidding me? You know, so just various. You know, there's the changes in the body, and then there's also just the way that society sort of treats women who are mothers, and the idea that, oh, this is all you are now, right? Like, you are only allowed to sort of be, you know, this mother person, and that is your primary duty. There's something about that sort of being subsumed by this presence in your body, just, you know, both in the physical and the social level, just really terrifies me. And so that was my personal oubliette. And so that was where that sort of, previous to this, I had only ever accidentally been horror. I never did so intentionally. And my accidental horror was also about, you know, giving birth to children. And so I was like, okay, Leslie, there's clearly something going on here. And so it just worked out that this was where sort of, you know, when it came to, articulating fears in a way that that could be sort of outwardly scary, I thought, okay, this is, you know, I feel this so viscerally that I think that this is something that I'd be able to depict on the page in a terrifying way.
It's genuinely terrifying. The first time I read the story, I was reading it aloud with someone else, and just we were sort of taking turns shrieking a little bit. And anyway, so in the introduction to the book, Jordan Peele writes, "I view horror as catharsis through entertainment. It's a way to work through your deepest pain and fear. But for Black people, that isn't possible, and for many decades wasn't possible without the stories being told in the first place." And he describes the anthology as like 19 personalized sunken places. Yes. I like how your cat is adding atmosphere to this episode.
or maybe that's the alien from her story.
I mean, right. We've never had such good sound effects. Anyway, so I thought that this quote by Jordan Peele was so interesting because it kind of means that representation in horror is maybe even more than in other genres, kind of a matter of emotional survival. And I was wondering if you thought, I mean, is that why Black horror has become such a dominant genre right now? Or are there other reasons to kind of go along with that?
You know, I don't know enough to answer that definitively, but I always think of what is really funny is sort of like the idea, and, you know, sort of, you know, Black people have had this joke amongst ourselves, and then you've seen it play out in some horror movies where it's like, oh, you know, the white folks always go towards the noise. And the fact you're like, no, I'm not gonna check that out. I'm gonna, you know, and this is like that's sort of almost a meme at this point, right?
Well, that's the Eddie Murphy routine that the name of the movie right? Get Out comes from, yes, right? That was a great routine that I used to quote all the time with my friends when we were in college.
In the Amityville Horror, the ghost told them to get out the house. White people stayed in there. Now that's a hint and a half for your ass. A ghost say get the fuck out, I would just tip the fuck out the door. They walked and looked in the toilet bowl, was blood in the toilet. They said, that's peculiar. I would have been in the house and said, oh, baby, this is beautiful. We got a chandelier hanging up here, kids outside playing. It's a beautiful neighborhood. We ain't got nothing to wear. I really love them. This is really nice. Get out. Too bad we can't stay, baby.
Yes, and so that was very, like, he very much articulated a conversation that we've had, sort of amongst ourselves. And so, I think it's this idea that, oh, like, life as a Black person is scary enough that, if there's a noise in the dark, you don't go seeking it out because it's just like, ah, like, that's, I'm just gonna avoid that and sort of maintain, like, this calm space that I currently have.
When the
And
voice
so,
in the
you know,
house
and
says,
to,
get out, you get out.
you get out exactly right. No, I'm not going to go hunt down the source, right? So, oh, the call's coming from inside the house. Well, I'm going to get out of the house. So that's how's that. So it's interesting sort of seeing this, renaissance of horror. So thinking about, like, in was it the 70s or the 80s, or maybe even backdating this more than I should, but the Candyman and oh gosh, what was the other sort of classic Black horror movie that I'm forgetting now? But, like, so like this feels like very much this feels very new and, like, very much like an interest a renaissance in a very interesting way. And it's really interesting how I'm not sure that Get Out could have happened with, like, outside of this particular or outside of the particular moment that it. It became a phenomenon because I feel like the general public was familiar enough with some of the co like conversations about race for that to be impactful in a very interesting way. Whereas if it had come out maybe 30 years ago, I'm not sure that it would have had the same impact, right? Because we the conversations were happening in smaller spaces than they did than they are now, and they were when Get Out first came out.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
Like, thinking about this, it's so amazing, right? There is also kind of the joke about, if you're watching a horror movie and there is, like, the Black friend from, like, a certain era, like, you knew that the Black friend was going to die. It was like the people on Star Trek wearing red shirts. You were like, those people are goners. Boy, I hope I got that right. Otherwise, all of the Trekkies who listen to our show will write back to me. But anyway, but it's just like the person who kind of is right. And in retrospect, that seems so ridiculous because probably that would have been the person with the most common sense who would have been like, don't run towards the noise, actually. So I remember you telling me that in the editorial process for this story, you'd had to kind of nip off a little bit that went past your actual ending to the story because of length, and we wondered if we might offer our listeners an exclusive glimpse into this.
Yes, so there was a very there's a pretty strict word limit, and my story was very was pushing against that word limit, and I sort of had that conversation with myself where, do I really want to be the jerk who's like, can I have more space, and so I was like, no, I don't. And so I sort of found what felt like the most natural stop, that where, okay, like, this ending is a little abrupt, but I think but it can it, there's something cohesive about it. And so I stopped the story earlier than I had intended because the my original ending went a bit further, and I was like, I'm not sure how to wrap this up in a way that is satisfying, meets the word requirements. And so I just like lopped it off at a natural an abrupt but natural stopping point. And so there's a little bit that goes on after the original ending. I told myself that, oh, I was gonna wait, and if like everyone was talking about how clever the ending was, I'd be like, oh yeah, that was intentional, that's totally what I meant to do all along. But otherwise then I can say, oh, actually no, this is not that was not the original ending. This it does go on further, and it does. So I am happy to read a little bit from or read that sort of original ending. All right, so just to set this up, this happens, of course, towards the end of the story when the that's sort of introduced in the beginning finds herself finds herself in a lab attending a birth. Just put it that way. At first, I think I'm hyperventilating, but the breaths come from an open door to the lab. Rachel checks on Olivia, then brings a stethoscope back to me. She kneels in front of me. my shirt away from my belly, and I don't understand until I do and I want to die. She settles cool metal onto my abdomen and listens. When, I whisper. Think about it, she whispers back. She heads to the lab, then turns back. While you still remember who you are, just make peace with what's happening. It makes everything easier. While I still remember who I am, I palm the stun gun, sliding it into my blazer sleeve. I make it to the doorway as Olivia grabs the top of the bed and grunts, strains, squeals. The aliens keep trying until they got us right, but they didn't stop there. We held every specimen for the last 2 years, obliterated. I think through molasses, past the buzzing. I think, I analyze. It won't let me. Nothing to analyze. We have no anatomical data. We have no idea what changes, what improvements they've made since Miami. We have no idea what they're preparing for. It's like a bell, the epiphany, the clarity returning me to myself. They are preparing for something our bodies aren't going to survive. I reach under Olivia to where a wiry, muscled arm has emerged from between her legs. When it anchors a fist into the mattress and begins to pull, it's a 100,000 volts at 2 very illegal amps. I hold it to the skin, baby soft, muscled like a laborer's, until I gag on the roast turkey smell. Olivia rears back onto her haunches, spots the limp arm, and screams. She keeps screaming and flails until she falls off the hospital bed and scrabbles around like she's trying to get away from it. When I approach her, my stun gun fools her enough that she pulls it to her chest. Please, kill me. It is the first time I'm speaking to the real Olivia Schultz. She slaps at the arm until I grab her. Don't look at it. Don't think about it. Hey, look at me. They're still on my head. Tell me everything. Tell me everything. And that's as far as I got.
Thank you very much. I was thinking there's some comparisons there that I could think of between Get Out, which we've been talking about, which involves like these, I'm not going to care about spoilers in a movie that's been out for 3 years. You know, these black citizens who've been kidnapped by a white family, and then like the consciousness of their white ancestors are implanted in them, right? So that there's two consciousnesses living in a head, right? Which is sort of what you're talking about there with that that woman who's giving birth, and she's like there, but there's another alien consciousness in there. So those are comparisons. But also, your story, at least when I was reading about it, didn't seem specifically about race in the way that like Tanana Reeve Dew's story is about like two freedom riders going to Montgomery. And I wondered if maybe the maturing of this genre is like the freedom to not explicitly write about race.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, that was part of the instruction that we were given when we were sort of, you know, charged with, okay, when you write this piece for this, you know, Black horror anthology, was that it does not have to distinctly be a racialized experience. Essentially, like, you're Black, you're writing horror, and so this is Black horror. And so that was, you know, so that was interesting, and I think that you know, that was, I think it was something that was important for, both of the editors, you know, but, you know, sort of with Peele's version, you know, for this anthology, was the idea that, you know, like Black horror can look many different ways, you know, everything from, you know, masquerades to mermaids, you know, in this anthology, to, you know, dystopias and, you know, the end of the world. And so, you know, it's a really wide ranging anthology that just sort of covers, you know, so many different, you know, sort of terrifying scenarios. Yeah.
So there are some, you know, icons of this genre, N.K. Jemisin, Nnedi Okafor, and Jemisin's story, Reckless Eyeballing, which I also find terrifying, opens the book. There's a great story called Eye and Tooth by Rebecca Roanhorse that, and Out There Screaming, I think, comes from that story. And then I remember you telling me that you had a particular, you discovered new writers by being in this anthology, writers whose work you hadn't been familiar with and whose work you really loved. And I wonder if you could, can you talk a little bit about some of the other stories in the volume and how they're in conversation with your work and with Jordan Peele's aesthetic?
Yes. You know, I had encountered the Venus Effect back. This is not the story they call by Violet Allen. This is not the story that she has in her anthology, but it's a story that I had read before I knew she was even in this anthology that I just absolutely love. It's a work of genius. And so when I saw her name in this anthology, I was very excited to see what would come of it. And this is sort of this very, what I love about Allen is that it's very funny and voicey in a very specific way, and in a way that seemingly works across on pretty much any genre. And so the Venus Effect, it was sort of more sort of science fiction, and in this case is very much, fantasy horror, and it just works. I just find her writing to be just delightful. In this collection that really just terrified me was Flicker, which is a story about sort of the end of the world, and I was so terrified. Flicker by L.D. Lewis, and I was so terrified by the story that I jumped ahead to the end because I was like, I cannot take my heart is in my throat. I can't take this anymore. And these are two very different stories. But in addition to the mermaid story, Les Siren by make sure I get that name right, by Aaron E. Adams. So these are sort of very different stories, and they're all just very terrifying in their own way. And I don't know that they speak exactly to Get Out, but all of the stories that terrified me have this idea of displacement in the body. And so I'm sure there's something to explore there, this idea that, your body's not yours, or your body can be taken from you at any point. And there's something very sort of awful and terrifying about it. And, when I thought about, when in the high, when we were sort of hearing about all of the symptoms and the lasting effects, for me, the most terrifying one was this idea of losing sort of like the sharpness of my mind in some way, people dealing with the brain fog. Like, that was the most terrifying aspect of COVID for me. I thought, okay, I can deal with like the physical aspect. The idea that I would lose some of the sharpness of my mind was something that was terrifying to me. And so anything that sort of hints at or speaks to the sort of like the removal from your own body just really bothers me.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
So I know that you also, my new colleague, Megan Giddings, a brilliant novelist, who has also spoken about kind of the intersection of horror and truth, especially for Black people, like kind of, is it horror? Is it realism? So some people, of course, are turning to horror for escapism, but her comment and the kind of many echoes of that rippling through some of this work suggest the opposite. I'm curious about the surprising refuge that horror might provide in a world that has already got its dial turned up lately anyway. I mean, and also throughout history we're like a fucking 12 out of 10. So what does it mean to engage with our worst fears in a world that keeps manifesting them?
There are several stories in this collection that essentially reimagine historical events or historical scenarios through this idea of like, this is Black history, but the perpetrator of this terror on this Black community of this Black person is just the monster in the dark. But when you sort of dig into the history of it, it's like Bliss's story, for example, right? It was set in a very real Black community in outside of Indianapolis. You think of Tatiana Reed's story. Her story is also researched and set in. And so this idea that these events are so outrageous that you could assign them to near mythical monsters and they would still produce a story that makes logical sense. Like, there's something to sort of speak of there, of sort of like the horror, the sort of historical horrors that have been visited on Black people in on American soil.
I agree, and I actually was thinking about that quote I read from Tana Reeve do earlier, because, you know, Beloved is it's in its own way a perfectly righteous horror story, you know?
Yes, it is. And, you know, yeah, and like, you know, it's just, you know, it's just the idea that, you know, anytime you have any sort of extreme, right, there is almost, it's almost the impetus to assign it to something that is like otherworldly or sort of out of the realm of, you know, the quote unquote possible. I say quote unquote possible because everyone's ideas of possibilities are varied. And so, yeah, so it's really interesting to sort of see that, particularly the idea of ghosts being revisited in a lot of these, you know, historical backstories over and over again.
Especially as I was reading the first story in here, The Reckless Eyeballing, which features a nefarious cop, Carl. I was also thinking of Peter Hodevy's story, The Hull Case, in which is about a couple and the husband is a Black veteran and the wife is a white nurse who had been in the armed forces. And they have a story of being abducted by aliens. And there's kind of a question of like, who's going to believe that story, right? And who can they tell it to? Who are the authorities who would believe it? So I don't know, like, again, they're like the otherworldly thing that you mentioned, I think, is like what was making me think of this, right? Because there's ghosts and then there's also aliens. And then there's this kind of nebulous space in between when you're like, which one are you? And like, if I even go and tell this, and like, and also your comment about like, right, the bounds of plausibility, like this is not the same. But I think at the moments in when I'm being read by other people and they're like, is that actually plausible? It's actually always about something horrifying.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, whatever horrible thing that you could imagine, someone has done that to another person, honestly. And there's something about that is very terrifying. And, you know, this idea that it is within like the sort of within the boundaries of a human experience to have someone perpetrate this level of horror on another. And so, you know, now a lot of there's a lot of very popular ideas of dystopia, right, or ideas of like how the world is going to end. And I think it's really interesting that that's what we're thinking about now, like, okay, you know, like this is, you know, many different people's versions of how they imagine the world ending. And like, what does it mean that a lot of our fiction now imagines like it's all over, you know? And like, what is it, you know, like what is sort of happening to us psychologically that is where our culture imagination is? Like, something about that is very disturbing.
Yeah. Leslie, thank you so much for being with us and giving us this glimpse into what Black horror is doing now, and I'm excited to see what horrifying thing you write next. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Listeners, don't miss Out There Screaming, available now, as well as Leslie's fantastic story collection, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Ann Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!